you've got to be super cognizant of vegetable oils. And I'm even talking about like stuff that a lot of people think is healthy. All your almonds and your handfuls of Brazil nuts and those nut butters you love to dip the tablespoon into. You should treat all of those like condiments. So a cheat day, let's say on pizza, that's not a cheat day, it's a cheat month, because your body is using all of those oils to comprise your cell membranes for the next 30 and up to 90 days.
Welcome to the next episode of What's Next with Eric Wood, presented by TwinSpires. Our next guest, I'm thrilled to have on today because I've followed his work for years, and that's Ben Greenfield. Ben is a human performance consultant, speaker, and New York Times bestselling author of 17 books. His work played a huge role in my transformation in weight and overall wellness these past 3 years since being forced to retire from pro football. You will receive practical advice from a health standpoint and also be impacted by his words surrounding his faith. There are over 100,000 new podcasts being released each week, so it means a ton to me that you spent your time tuning into this episode. Please rate, review, and subscribe, and enjoy the podcast. Ben, welcome to the show.
What's up, Eric? Thanks for having me on.
I'm fired up for this one, honestly. I've followed your work for years, been a huge fan. I was telling my wife earlier, I've probably listened to between 50 and 100 hours of audio content of podcast appearances that you've been on, podcasts
you've done. That's all 100? Jeez, man, step it up. Come on.
Yeah, let's go.
Unless that's on like the 6x speed setting on your podcast player, in which case I'll grant you 50 to 100 hours.
Let's start off by telling the listeners about where you're from and what type of athlete were you growing up?
Well, I'm from Lewiston, Idaho. That's where I was born. And went to college at University of Idaho in Moscow, Idaho. And now I live in Spokane, Washington, which is on the border of Idaho. So Idaho born in the Northwest is my locale. It's where my biome is most comfortable, or at least where my kids and wife like to be, because we're close to family, which is awesome.
Yep.
And that's where we set up our roots. I wasn't that great of an athlete growing up, honestly. Everything I did and everything I do still now in the athletic sector comes very hard to me. I'm one of those guys that has to practice. And honestly, I kind of learned that I do best practicing probably because I'm introverted when nobody's looking at me. Right. So I'd go in, learn the skills and just like lock myself away in my room with my tennis racket and do, you know, shadow swings against the wall. Or, you know, it's not really a sport, but, you know, I took a firearms course just last week, and, you know, I'm in my office, you know, dry firing my Glock at little dots on the wall, you know, before I go to the range, because that's how I practice. I like to just lock myself away and go. But I never picked things up that fast. But, you know, I played a little bit of soccer, a little bit of baseball, a little bit of basketball. Didn't do much football. Sorry, Eric. My mom was, she was probably an early adopter of the parental phobia of TBI and concussion in children. She used to make me wear a freaking helmet when I climbed trees. But probably part of that is because of all the concussions I got riding my mountain bike growing up, to be honest with you. So I guess mountain biking was okay, but football wasn't. So anyway, I really though got super of all the sports I played. I got super into tennis. And that's what really kind of drew me out of being a really introverted, geeky, you know, I was homeschooled. I was super intellectual, super book driven, happy as a clam, just studying all day. And, you know, going to the library was my hotspot. And tennis, though, really introduced me to the world of physical culture, to the world of weightlifting. Met a couple mentors in high school, a bodybuilder and a powerlifter who kind of taught me the ropes at the gym. So I kind of became a little bit of a gym rat through high school, wound up getting recruited onto a college tennis team, and played for a couple years, and then walked off the team. And that was primarily just because I'm gonna disable my Slack notifications here so they're not disrupting us. I walked off the team and began to just toy around with a variety of other sports. Kind of my philosophy in life is, later on, I got an Ironman triathlon and decided I didn't want to be that 50-year-old guy who all he knows is staring at a black line at the bottom of the pool and being hunched over a bike. It's like I've given myself permission to kind of like milk what I want to milk out of a sport and then move on to the next one. And so, so I stopped playing tennis and at University of Idaho, started practicing with the water polo team and started playing hole set for the water polo team, which I loved. That's probably the strongest my legs have ever been in my life. Was that, having to do that egg beater kick in water polo, and a typical training session, not only are you scrimmaging for, 2 or 3 hours, which is difficult in water polo, because if you stop moving, you basically die. So you gotta get out of the pool if you're gassed. And, lots of like med ball tosses from someone on deck, 50-pound med ball drop into the pool and your egg beaten to do basically the equivalent of an underwater thruster and toss that med ball back out of the pool. A lot of hypoxic training, a lot of breath work training before breath work training was sexy, and, just the ability to be able to survive and thrive in the water in a competitive scenario. I also played middle for the men's volleyball team, and, we wound up going to nationals and I just absolutely loved that. I'm 6'2", but trained my vertical for a while. And this was before I got into endurance sports. So I had enough fast twitch muscle fibers to do that. Played a lot of volleyball, played a lot of water polo, played a lot of club basketball. And then, based on a dare from one of my buddies, signed up for a bodybuilding competition and just trained my butt off in the gym for about 9 months, packed on around 25 pounds of muscle, this was when I was a poor college student and couldn't afford illegal performance enhancing aids or anything like that. So right. it was all creatine and the pre-workout. I think it was, what's it called? The red line powder. I mean, all of them were essentially the equivalent of sildenafil and ephedra, but pre-workout aids, tons and tons of man in a can, chemical infused protein shakes, and then tuna with relish stirred into it, anything else you can do to make tuna cans taste better. And super high protein, super low carbs, super low fat, and because I'm kind of like a lean gainer, a lot of full body complex lifts, almost more like a powerlifting approach to bodybuilding, where I do full body complexes, cleans and deadlifts and squats and presses 3 days of the week. And then I had a couple other days where I do a little bit of cardio for body fat percentage, and then some vanity exercises, so to speak, to kind of tune up little parts that I wanted to look good on stage. And then, once I finished that bodybuilding competition and ate a lot of carbohydrates afterwards, after not touching them for about 9 months, I wound up deciding to sign up for a triathlon. And so I did a local triathlon called the Palouse Sprint Triathlon down in Moscow, Idaho, and just fell in love with swimming and biking and running and, all things I don't, obviously I already swam as a water polo athlete and rode my bike everywhere. I didn't have a car, so I just rode my bike everywhere and really had never run more than a mile, because you don't want to do that in an explosive sport like tennis or water polo or anything like that. You don't want to really get rid of your fast twitch muscle fibers. So I kind of gradually built up my endurance and eventually a couple of years into triathlon, signed up for an Ironman, competed in Ironman for like 10 years. And then I shifted into adventure racing and obstacle course racing. So I signed up for a Spartan race. I showed up in my spandex and that was all I owned for racing gear was, the cycling spandex, down to the little, the diaper in the crotch, the chamois that you have there in the bicycling shorts. And yeah, just showed up looking like a total tool at this Spartan race and thought I was just going to dominate because I heard it was, this endurance event. But I couldn't climb a rope. I couldn't like carry a heavy bucket. I couldn't throw a spear. Like I'd never climbed a rope in my life. I didn't even know how. Wow. I didn't really have PE in homeschool, and so I didn't have ropes or anything like that. So I remember the lead female passed me 3 miles into the race, and I'm like, oh my goodness, I got my work cut out for me here. So as I do with most sports, I just I built a bunch of obstacles in my backyard and started practicing, and eventually got recruited to the Reebok Pro Team and competed professionally for a couple of years. That was up until about a year and a half ago. And then, I just kind of decided to take it easy for a while. And now I play a little bit of family tennis. I do a little bow hunting, I'm starting to get into a little bit of, like I mentioned, shooting and firearms training. Little bit of rolling, a little bit of jiu-jitsu, but not too much. That's primarily my twin boys' sport of choice, but I hop in there with them every once in a while. And we play a little family tennis, and I do a lot of walking, a lot of hiking. And what I would say is arguably a more sustainable fitness and sports protocol compared to the masochistic, unhealthy sports of bodybuilding or triathlon. But, you know, who knows? A year from now, I might be just playing golf. I don't know. But that's kind of where I come from and what my sports background is.
Man, super interesting journey. I love how you've tried it all. I used to think football was the most dangerous sport out there, but now I believe water polo is. The threat of drowning probably outweighs.
There's fear of collision. What goes on underneath the water that you don't see? That's true. I mean, it's like, you know, ball grabs and back rake scraping with the guys who've grown their fingernails out long for that, and leg locks. And if you watch the old USA-Russia competition from the Olympics, it was in the 80s. I forget which year, but the water's red from the blood in the water from all the wounds these guys are inflicting on each other. So I don't think it's more dangerous than football. But, yeah, there's a lot that goes under the water in that sport that I think a lot of people are unaware of. And there's this new league I've been following on Instagram. They're in California, the Underwater Torpedo League. I don't know if you've seen this.
No.
Yeah, it's an underwater football. It's kind of like underwater water polo, right? But it's like a football that you can throw under the water. And it's very similar rules to water polo. You know, the football, it's like a torpedo. But it's all under the water, right? And so it's all breath hold training and everything is under the water. You could Google it or check out their Instagram page. So next time I'm down in California, I want to jump in and train with those guys and see what that sport is all about.
Yeah, I love how you're willing to try anything. That allows you to speak into so many different types of people, is that you've been on so many different types of journeys. That's what partially appeals to me so much about your work, is how well-rounded you are. And I also find it interesting when introverts, you know, you're a self-proclaimed introvert, and now you're in a space of speaking, writing, and you're so phenomenal through your podcast. And so that always amazes me. And there's so many different directions.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, the introvert thing, sorry to interrupt. I don't want to be rude, but I just had a thought. You know, with the introverted thing, obviously writing is not something you would not expect an introvert to do. And I love to write. That's something I've identified as something God has equipped me with, as a thing that comes easy to me, something I love to do, and something I can be impactful with. So I certainly don't neglect that God-given talent. But speaking's interesting, because if you read a book like Susan Cain's Power of Introverts, or you look at what a lot of introverts are good at, it's surprising. Introverts actually tend to be very good actors and very good speakers, because when an introvert steps onto stage or onto a video screen or anything like that, they have to overcome the introversion, become a different character, right? And actually project almost like in an acting sense, someone different than they actually feel they might be inside, not in an inauthentic sort of way. But, you know, when I step up onto stage, you know, let's say I'm giving a lecture to a bunch of doctors on testosterone optimization or something like that, I actually, you know, say, okay, I'm Ben, the scientifically informed lecturer who's able to talk intelligently with these docs, who's done my research, and I'm going to pretend I'm like wearing a white lab coat up here, you know, with a nerdy set of glasses and maybe a pen protector, and that's who I am. And I'll take on that character and I'll get on stage. And that, you know, tactics like that help, I think, an introvert do well on stage. But it is interesting that introverts, because this is interesting. It's something else you see introverts do. And I find that I've identified this in myself as well. They tend to be very chameleon-esque. Whereas, and I'm sure any introverts listening in, or maybe you, Eric, if you're the same way, like when you travel to a foreign country or you're hanging around people who have an accent, you very quickly adopt the accent or pick up the language or the mannerisms or the hand movements or anything that someone in a different culture is projecting at you, which is kind of a catch-22. It makes you very relatable and allows you to pick on new languages and cultural customs very quickly. It can also sometimes keep you from being your true authentic self in a way. Absolutely. Like if you're hanging out with somebody from the Bronx and you start kind of talking like this a little bit, you know, it's interesting. But yeah, being introverted doesn't necessarily mean
that you are kind of like that classical image of an introvert, just like, you know, super shy and you're going to, you know, you'd rather die than speak in front of people, et cetera. You know, my wife is extremely extroverted and she hates public speaking because she has to be herself when she gets on stage, whereas I can be anybody I want when I get on stage.
Yeah, that's phenomenal points there. Let's start here. Obviously, you know my story. I played 9 years in the NFL, left with a career-ending neck injury, but I had 6 lower body surgeries along the way. Playing center, I start every play with my hand between my legs. It caused a lot of brain contact, head contact, which can result in some TBI as well. What tips would you have for specifically recovering your body and promoting neuroplasticity to promote brain healing from your end towards me?
Oh, holy cow. That is a loaded question. We can borrow from the increasingly informed world of Alzheimer's and dementia research, I think, to really tackle this issue. And that's where the lion's share of a lot of the recommendations for management of TBI and concussion come from. And if you look at a book like, let's say, you know, Dale Bredesen's End of Alzheimer's, which is a fantastic book in which he's demonstrated multiple case studies of a near reversal of Alzheimer's, slowing of dementia, et cetera. Some of the foremost strategies that seem to work really well from a nutritional standpoint would be some element of ketosis, limiting the amount of glucose that the brain is utilizing as a fuel, and instead putting ketones into the brain as a more stable throughput for glial cells, which tend to produce a lot of free radicals and produce more kind of like risk for a lot of those neurofibrillary tangles and amyloid plaques when glucose is the preferential fuel. So not only like nutritional ketosis, but even the use of things like ketone salts, ketone esters, a lot of these supplements that shift you into a state of ketosis more readily. So that would be like from a dietary standpoint. I'm not talking about like a modernized, say like what you might call a dirty keto diet, where it's just like, you know, ribeye steaks and coconut oil fat bombs in your freezer. I'm talking about more of like kind of like a Mediterranean plant-based polyphenol, flavanol rich, antioxidant rich ketogenic diet with a wide variety of herbs and spices that are also fantastic for healing a leaky blood-brain barrier or providing more antioxidants to the brain for some of the inflammation that tends to be present for things like TBI and concussion. So almost, almost like a low carb Mediterranean diet versus like a modernized, you know, stick of butter in your coffee, modern keto diet. And such a diet would also include some elements of fasting, which can shift you very readily into ketosis, like a daily 12 to 16 hour intermittent fast, possibly a couple of times a month, like a 24 hour dinner time to dinner time fast. Perhaps once a quarter, an elongated fast, like a 3 to 5 day reduced calorie or bone broth fast or juice fast, where you're allowing for even more autophagy, which is fantastic for brain health, all that cellular cleanup, which is basically what autophagy is. So from a nutritional standpoint, those are some of the tactics that seem to work really well. From kind of like a supplementation standpoint, you know, I mentioned ketones and ketone esters, and a lot of the research that Dominique DiAgostino has been doing down in Florida definitely shows benefits to supplementation with those. Even if you're already following like a lower carbohydrate protocol, adding those in kind of shifts you into ketosis more readily. If they're expensive, because they are, and they're not within your budget, coconut oil and even better MCT oil can do a similar thing, albeit they also introduce, especially with coconut oil, more calories, or with MCT oil, a little bit bigger risk of gastric upset. So, you know, you just have to kind of be careful with dosage and timing with those. But anyways, in addition to the ketones, fish oil, particularly DHA, which could also be derived from like algal oil or krill oil, but higher dose fish oil. You know, Charles Poliquin, you know, a strength training expert who has since passed, would put many of his athletes on very high dose fish oil, like 40 grams a day. And I don't think that any research indicates that that's necessary, but slightly higher dose, like in the 6 to 8 gram range for fish oil, along with the inclusion of a lot of DHA rich fish that are low on the food chain. So there's this concept called the SMASH diet: sardines, mackerels, anchovy, salmon, and herring, right? Like those are like the staples of your pantry for fish, along with a good, you know, a good brand of fish oil or krill oil or algae oil. And, you know, for me personally, I don't have many
cognitive or TBI related issues, but I have a whole closet full of, you know, sardines and anchovies and stuff from this company called Wild Planet, because they're like lower in metals and
yep.
and they're just you open up the can and eat them. My kids love to eat the sardines for lunch. And so a lot of fish oil, a lot of ketones. There are certain nootropics that seem to increase blood flow to the brain and can be helpful for either neuroplasticity or blood flow to the brain, which when paired with a lot of these antioxidant-rich herbs and spices like ginger, turmeric, curcumin, garlic, you know, onion, a lot of these kind of bitter, pungent herbs and spices can be really helpful. So what I'm referring to when it comes to some of those blood flow precursors, it would be like betaine or beetroot extract, arginine, citrulline, any of these things that kind of give you like a full body Viagra effect, including blood flow to the brain. Huperzine is another one that works pretty well. Acetylcholine is another. There's a ginkgo biloba. And what I want to tell you is there's a fantastic website at altsdiscovery.org, as in Alzheimer's discovery. Altsdiscovery.org is devoted to doing a robust scientific review of all of the different supplements in particular, right? Like ginkgo biloba or modafinil or piracetam or any of these things. And it rates them based on safety, efficacy, and research. And so you can literally go there and just kind of like rank prioritize the ones that seem to do the best job accomplishing a lot of that decreased neural inflammation and increased blood flow to the brain. So that's a very helpful website from a supplementation standpoint. You know, of course, as you know, there's been a lot of chatter these days about plant medicine-based protocols for TBI and concussion. And I would kind of lump that into the supplementation or the medicines category. In particular, the ones that seem to be most beneficial would be psilocybin, particularly if it's combined with a medicinal mushroom like lion's mane and a blood flow precursor such as niacin. That's a very common stack for brain health. Another would be ibogaine. I recently on my own podcast interviewed a Navy SEAL named Nick Norris, who indicated some pretty good use for ibogaine for both TBI and concussion, as well as post-traumatic stress disorder. A lot of the others, you know, the research is scant, but there's a little bit on Wachuma, which is like a San Pedro cactus extract. Possibly some variants of microdosing with LSD, particularly a lysergamide called LSA, may also be helpful in small doses and quite scary and or fun in large doses. So any of those you want to be careful with, because obviously they latch onto the serotonin receptors just like so intensively that as anyone knows, if you take too much, you're going to be unproductive on a different planet and potentially incapable of being as impactful as God wants you to be with your life and your day. So you need to be careful with those and only take them in very small doses if you're using them for something like brain health. And then there's in addition to food and supplements, technologies, right? And some of the technologies that work very well, one is hyperbaric oxygen therapy, which, you know, for a time was really only available, you know, in hospitals and in health clinical settings, these big hard shell chambers that you get into that pressurize oxygen and concentrate oxygen, allowing the brain to be flooded with helpful oxygen. Now there are many companies that sell soft shell chambers for home use. They don't go up to quite as high a pressure of oxygen or an atmospheric pressure when you're inside the chamber, but they're still quite useful and quite obviously convenient, especially when you consider that for TBI and concussion management, the use of hyperbaric oxygen therapy appears to best be utilized on a daily or very consistent basis. So if you own your own that you're getting into for like a nap or some of your reading or whatever during the day, it's going to be far better than say like driving to a clinic a couple of times a week to try and hunt one down in a clinic. And they're not super expensive, some of these soft shell units. In addition to that, light therapy can be very effective. Light therapy for the head, also known as photobiomodulation. There are companies such as Vielight, VIE Light, that sell a head-worn infrared and red therapy device that triggers activity of mitochondria in neural tissue and can be very effective for not only just increased cognition or, you know, I kind of describe it, feels like a cup of coffee for your brain, but there's also good evidence for that, for TBI, for concussion, for dementia, for Alzheimer's. And so I would rank that up there along with hyperbaric oxygen as a pretty useful modality.
And although there are many others, probably the last one I would name just for the sake of time, and then I'll give you a couple more resources, would be cold thermogenesis, particularly not cryotherapy chambers, because the head doesn't get wet enough, nor is there enough pressure from the water against the skin to cause that great of a cooling effect, but literally like cold water immersion, and in particular getting the head under the water during cold water immersion, which could be something as simple as if you live in an area where you have cold water, taking a very icy cold shower and making sure your head is under that shower head, to filling your sink with ice and water and doing cold water face dunks in the sink and just keeping that full during the day. And, you know, whenever you walk by the sink, just dipping your head in there 5-10 times and cooling off the head and continuing on to the use of some of these larger kind of like done for you cold tubs. Like I have one called a Marazco Forge, and it sits outside my office. It stays at about 32 degrees, and I could put my whole body in there, or I could put my head in there. But cold water immersion, particularly for the head, seems to do a really good job at controlling neural inflammation, increasing blood flow to the brain, et cetera. And then I mentioned the book, The End of Alzheimer's by Dale Bredesen. There's also a book called The Concussion Repair Manual by Dr. Dan Engel, who also does quite a bit of like some of those plant medicine type of protocols, particularly for TBI and concussion. And he's got a couple good clinics, I think, in Boulder and in Austin. And so Dale Bredesen is good. Dan Engel is good. That altsdiscovery.org website is good. And there's one other, and I'm blanking, I think it's cognitiveusa.com or something like that, but it's a clinic based out of, I believe, Salt Lake City. And they do a really robust TBI and concussion management protocol. And you actually go there and live there for a couple of weeks, and they have, you know, everything, the hyperbaric and the lasers and the supplements. And I'm blanking on the name, but I think it's Cognitive USA. And I think it's Salt Lake City, but that clinic seems to be kind of at the forefront of adopting and implementing a lot of the stuff for TBI and concussion management. So, I mean, those are at least a few places to start.
That is one heck of a start. And when you ask Ben Greenfield a question, now you understand what type of info you're getting when you tune into a podcast specifically on coffee or biohacking the brain, whatever it may be. You're going to get that type of information. We will link as many of those references we can in the show notes. I also hope you're taking notes, and don't you dare have this one on 1.5 speed, because you're going to miss a lot. Everyone thinks I'm crazy in my household. I have a 5 and a 3-year-old, and then my wife as well, because I have the hyperbaric oxygen chamber. I have a sauna that uses red light therapy as well. I did a 6-month protocol with Dr. Daniel Amen, and I didn't change a whole lot of lifestyle factors, much at all, maybe a little bit different supplementation from a vitamin standpoint, but the only change was hyperbaric oxygen chamber, and the blood flow in my brain after 6 months was dramatically different using his SPECT scans. So there is a lot of good info there, and that is beneficial to those that played contact sports for a living, that have had TBI, traumatic brain injury, but also for those out there that are hitting that dementia, that 60 or 65 year old that's just not as sharp as you can catch a lot of great info from what Ben shared right there. And for those out there,
by the way, Eric, real quick, I'm glad you brought that up, the SPECT scan by Dr. Daniel Amen, because those type of docs that can quantify via a scan either blood flow to the brain or electrical activity, meaning the actual, like what's called a QEEG, where you're looking at alpha, beta, delta, and in your theta brain waves, and looking at imbalances between those, or areas where blood flow is inadequate to the brain, and then you follow that up with some form of training, and then a rescan, or some form of therapy, and then a rescan. You know, that's obviously a little bit more intensive and time-consuming, and potentially inconvenient, because for those type of things, usually you do have to drive to a clinic or work with a practitioner. But I certainly see value in that. There's a clinic in LA. They are called the Peak Brain Institute. And I actually went there. I actually took my boys there as well. We all did a QEEG scan. We all identified areas of the brain where there were electrical abnormalities, areas of increased distractibility, ADD, ADHD-like symptoms, sleep onset issues, et cetera. And then we use neurofeedback training, which is super interesting. Neurofeedback training involves sitting in front of a screen with electrodes attached to your head. You look at the screen, and it might be, say, a game, like a spaceship flying. And every time your brain kind of shifts into, let's say,
a brainwave zone that you want to train out of, like too much beta brainwave production in a section of the brain, the ship will stop flying, or the ignition will stop coming out of the back of the engine, or the music will fade. And it's like a subconscious slap to your brain. And you do multiple training sessions. I was shocked at the QEEG scan results. I brought my kids down there for a week. We just stayed at an Airbnb. We went there every day, a couple of times a day for about a half hour to do the scans and the brain training. By the time we left there a week later, like our QEEGs were remarkably different. And I noticed lasting changes. Like I totally trained out the area of increased distractibility. And what I mean by that is I'd often before that walk into say like a cocktail party and I'd be talking to somebody, but I could hear the eight other conversations going on around me.
Yep.
And so I'd be trying to talk to the person in front of me, but kind of listening to all the other conversations as well. And after doing all that training, I found that I could just laser focus in on one conversation and not be distracted by all the, you know, the shiny pennies and the squirrels happening in other areas of the room. So yeah, there's something to that type of neural feedback training and like a quantified scan of the brain as well.
Yeah, definitely. I did something very similar to that. And I had the same thing. I had ADD reads on my brain, even though that based upon the testing, it might not say it, based upon the blood flow and the electric scans, everything they were doing, they were able to identify some ADD thought or ADD indications in my brain. I had the exact same thing. For those out there that are on the American Standard Diet and just looking for one or two things, if you could get, you start working with somebody, you're starting to consult with them, what are a couple easy changes they can make in their life to start on a better health and wellness plan?
Sure. From a dietary standpoint specifically, because that's what you asked, even though there are other variables I would of course address, which we could get into if we have time, but let's focus on the diet component for now. The two biggest variables really are inflammation and glycemic variability. Inflammation, most people have their heads wrapped around, you know, the inflammatory cytokines that to a certain extent are not damaging to the body and are in fact, you know, necessary for things like, you know, increasing production of mitochondria or muscle fiber growth in response to an exercise session, right? Like that's an example of good inflammation. But, you know, the number one contributor to harmful dietary inflammation is seed and nut and processed vegetable oils. We consume far, far more omega-6 fatty acids and those type of processed vegetable oils than our ancestors ever would have, ratios of 20 to 1 and beyond. In fact, it should be closer to 4 to 1 or lower. So I tell people, be cognizant of and ruthlessly eliminate vegetable oils. We're talking about when you're walking through the airport and you go into the healthy food section at the Hudson's Booksellers or whatever, and you grab your whatever, your beet and carrot chips and you bring them up to the front, you're slapping yourself on the back for walking past all the Cracker Jacks and the, you know, in the sour gummy worms. And then you get on the plane, you look on the back and it's like, you know, before it even says beet and carrot, what you have written on there are vegetable oil, usually like soybean or safflower or canola or whatever, organic, you know, cold pressed canola oil with unicorn tears. It doesn't matter. Like there's no reason that you should be consuming a vegetable oil in any appreciable quantity. Same thing when you go to a restaurant, like almost all the sauces, all the dressings, even at many nice restaurants, we assume they're using the best of ingredients, but you know, much of the extra virgin olive oil tends to be tainted with, for example, you know, canola oil. And so being cognizant of that, asking at restaurants, what do you cook these Brussels sprouts in at the steakhouse? Well, we don't know. Well, could you cook them in butter for me or coconut oil or extra virgin olive oil? You just ask, you just be that person. I actually have a fanny pack. I'm one of those guys who wears a fanny pack. I always have a little packet of really good salt in my fanny pack and a little like 4 ounce bottle of really great extra virgin olive oil. So if I'm at a restaurant, it's just like, I don't know about the sauces. I'll just whip out my olive oil and put it on there. The only time I ran into trouble with that was when I was in Japan, where apparently that's very culturally inappropriate and offensive to the chef to take out extra ingredients and spice the food. And he came running out of the kitchen and read me the riot act. But really, like you gotta be super cognizant of vegetable oils. And I'm even talking about like stuff that a lot of people think is healthy. All your almonds and your handfuls of Brazil nuts and those nut butters you love to dip the tablespoon into. You should treat all of those like condiments, like ketchup. Use them very small amounts to slightly upregulate the flavor of a meal that you might be eating, not as staple snacks or foods in your diet. If you really want to control a lot of the rampant inflammation that can occur from regular vegetable oil consumption, because those are fats and fats are used to comprise your cell membranes. So a cheat day, let's say on pizza, that's not a cheat day, it's a cheat month, because your body is using all of those oils to comprise your cell membranes for the next 30 and up to 90 days. And there are things you can do to mop up some of the damage. There's one researcher named Dr. James Michelantonio who has shown that, for example, the use of spirulina or taking about 4 grams of glycine can help to mop up some of the issues that are formed when you consume vegetables. Another one would be berberine, right? So berberine would be something some people take before a meal to lower blood sugar, but it also seems to be able to protect you a little bit from some of the ravages of vegetable oil. So there are ways you can undo some of the damage, but
are those in your Keon Lean product?
Keon Lean, which is a product I formulated for blood sugar control and fat loss, does not contain berberine, but it contains a very similar compound called bittermelon extract. And that would work similarly. Although, of course, the best strategy is just not eat vegetable oils. If you got to cheat on a big old wonderful, ribeye steak with some carrot or sweet potato fries that are baked, not fried, and a glass of organic red wine and maybe a little chunk of dark chocolate afterwards, right? You can have a wonderful cheat day and not have a bunch of vegetable oils. And then the other one would be glycemic variability, which is how often your blood sugar goes up and down during the day. Okay. So I'm not one of those guys who's like totally get rid of carbs, don't eat sugar. I mean, honestly, like if you came up to me and you offered me, let's say like a corn dog or a stick of cotton candy at the fair, I'd take the cotton candy 10 times out of 10, because that's just glucose, right? I can go walk that off or go to the gym and just burn it off. But like I just mentioned, all the oils in that corn dog are going to be with me for the next month, right? Wow. So the idea with glucose is not like completely eliminating sugars or starches, but it's being aware of how often you're consuming them and just being aware of how often you're eating in general. Because, if you, for example, wear one of these newer fancy continuous blood glucose monitors, which I do sometimes, you can really keep your finger on a pulse of how often your blood glucose is going up and down during the day. And the more it's going up and down, the more problematic that is from a health standpoint. So some of the things you can do to lower glycemic variability would be the use of some of those so-called glucose disposal agents we were just talking about, like berberine or bittermelon extract, prior to a meal that contains carbohydrates. Others that also work would be like a shot of apple cider vinegar, Ceylon cinnamon, a decent amount. Like you need about 2 teaspoons. Most people aren't going to have that with a meal unless it's like a morning smoothie. Let's say you're having a morning smoothie of blueberries and you don't want your blood glucose to spike as much in response to the blueberries. You put a couple teaspoons of Ceylon cinnamon into your morning smoothie along with those blueberries, so you can kind of sprinkle these type of glucose disposal agents in throughout the day, even in the evening when you're having a cocktail, right? If I'm out at a steakhouse and they come up and I'm ordering something off the cocktail menu, a lot of times I'll just tell them, hey, bring me a bunch of your house-made bitters. Or sometimes I'll just choose one. Like the other night I was at a restaurant, they had a tobacco-infused house-made bitter, right? But a lot of these bitters and digestifs that our ancestors have consumed for a long time, just as like a part of the diet to jumpstart the digestive enzymes prior to a meal. Even alcohol does that to a certain extent, but you want to be careful with drinking too much alcohol. And I don't know about you, but if I'm having a steak, I usually like to have a nice, like a nice big bold organic glass of wine with a steak. I always look at the wine menu and you choose 3 countries, France, Italy, or New Zealand. All those 3 countries still do a pretty good job with not using a lot of herbicides and pesticides in their wine. They keep things pretty organic. So, if I'm having a glass of wine and I'm being careful with how much alcohol I consume, I'll just have like some of those bitters and digestifs, shot of bitters on the rocks with some club soda or some tonic water thrown on top, right? And so even something like that can be a strategy to control your blood glucose response to, that wonderful, sourdough bread they might bring out to the table before your steak comes out. When I wore a continuous blood glucose monitor for a period of time, from a lifestyle strategy, the things that I found to control blood glucose most intensively were long periods of time between meals, like I just mentioned. So get yourself some, a Pellegrino or Gerolsteiner or sparkling water, a little bit of gum, and just keep your appetite stimulated with or satiated with things other than calories and snacks in between meals. right? B, some type of cold thermogenesis in the morning. I was shocked at how good a job a nice cold shower in the morning, or a dip into a cold river or lake or ocean, or going for a walk in the sunshine and finishing up with a couple minutes in the cold tub. Like, I can go punish a 900 calorie smoothie after that, and my blood glucose is just super stable. So cold is amazing. And then, I mean, I was even looking at a study just this morning over breakfast on how rapidly resistance training depletes muscle glycogen. And it doesn't have to be much. I mean, you can go, let's say you're having a big, I don't know, like a Sunday afternoon barbecue at your house. You know, you want to eat a lot. Go to the garage and do like, you know, five sets of 10 squats. And that not only upregulates the glucose transporters, but also depletes some muscle glycogen. So it creates almost like more of a sink for glucose to get disposed into. So there's all sorts of things you can do to control glycemic variability. A lot of those things I just mentioned. But yeah, from a dietary standpoint, it would be A, managing inflammation through the ruthless elimination of vegetable oils and being highly cognizant, especially of any packaged food that you eat and any dressings or sauces, particularly at restaurants that might contain vegetable oils. And then B, knowing what your blood glucose is, or at least being aware of the need to control it, and then working in a lot of these blood glucose disposal agents, cold, resistance training, and you know, compressed feeding periods or limited snacking during the day. Those are the two best places people can start.
That's incredible information. And a lot of those I try to implement. I need to be better about being adamant about missing out on those vegetable oils. The resistance training, maybe before our Easter Sunday meal, I always do something like that. I try to get in some type of cold exposure. I love the wintertime in Louisville, Kentucky, where I live, because I have a 44,000 gallon cold tub in the backyard because we leave our pool open. I lose that in the summer. That cold exposure turns into more cold showers and whatnot. I may use your ice water in the sink. Again, my wife will think I'm nuts, but that's all right. It's
good. I mean, those cold tubs, if you get one that doesn't have the built-in UV and ozone filtration, they're like 1.5 to 3K around in there. If you get like a fancy one that's filtered for you that you don't have to put chlorine and stuff into, it's like 4 to 6K. But I'm the same way. I have a above ground cold pool for just like fitness and stuff. They get super cold in the winter that I can just swim around in the winter. But in the summer, you know, for the longest time, I would like grab bags of ice from the gas station, you know, my way up to the house and dump those in the pool to keep it cold. And I finally bit the bullet and got one of these Marazco Forge, you know, cold tubs. And so, I mean, that thing will stay at 32 degrees when it's 110 degrees outside. So, you know, for me, that's worth it. So that's what I do now in the summer.
I'm excited to tell you about a product that I've been absolutely loving lately, and that's the Uller from Chili Pad. It is a temperature-controlled mat that goes under your sheets on your bed and controls your body temperature throughout the night. I originally heard this product endorsed by Tim Ferriss, Tony Robbins, David Nurse, and others, and I knew I had to give it a try. Maximizing the amount of deep sleep you get in a night is so important, especially when it's not possible at times to get a full 7 or 8 hours. Chili Pad puts you at the perfect temperature all night to promote deep sleep. When you get enough deep sleep, your learning capability is higher, your memory is stronger, you're prepared to take on your toughest workouts. In other words, you're in peak physical and mental shape after a night of true recovery. That's why finding a way to get more deep sleep is always at the top of my priority list. I will attach a link to purchase the Chili Pad in the show notes and use code ERIC22 at checkout to get 22% off your order. I personally use the Uller and I love it. That's awesome. Leslie, as you're listening to this podcast, when you're looking for something to give me for my birthday or Christmas next year, now you know what I want. Let's switch gears a little bit. You're very open about it being a committed follower of Christ in a space where a lot of scientists will try and disprove Christianity. How do you combat those naysayers in your current field?
Well, it depends on what they are saying. I mean, when you want to build up a response that defends the hope that is within you, which in Christianity or in religion is called the field of apologetics. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean the ability to be able to make an apology or say sorry. It means being able to just like defend why it is that you believe what you believe, why it is that you have hope and salvation, and why it is that you have that peace and love and joy that you're able to cast your burdens of sin and shame at the foot of the cross
and you're able to be, you know, saved and enter into eternal life and live and sing and, you know, traipse about a new heaven and a new earth for the rest of all time. You know, that's all wonderful. But then, you know, someone can come up to you and say, hey, we're just a bunch of chunks of flesh and blood on a giant rock floating through space. And there's zero evidence that shows that what you believe is actually true. You know, I think that one of the better kind of like defenses against that would be this idea of general revelation, meaning that God reveals himself to us through creation, through the wonders and the magic and the complexities of creation, the ability of plants to be able to communicate with each other, you know, and for trees to upregulate their endogenous plant defense mechanisms when a giraffe an acre away is chomping on that tree, and all of a sudden the tree a block down is has changed what it's putting out for its own phytochemicals based on that, or the ability of the underground rhizome and mycelial network to actually speak with one another, almost like the giant network that we see in the movie Avatar, you know, all the blue tendrils traveling through the ground. When we look at the you know, the vast variety of animals that are just so complex and widely varied that they're you can just almost feel silly suggesting that they were not created through some element of intelligent design. The hippo and the platypus and the zebra and the mole rat and this wide variety of complex and beautiful and ugly and you know, amazing creatures. And so I think that the one element of intelligent design is just the fact that it is so complex. And if you get down and do the math, and there's some great books about this. There's one book I recently read that's like 50 different scientists showing how mathematically there's really no chance that evolution could have created the complexity of even something as complex as a human eyeball. That you know, you to a certain extent can make an argument from the wonders of creation negating the possibility that some form of intelligent design was not actually responsible for the creation of the heavens and the earth that we exist upon. You know, if I'm talking to a scientist, that's one part of it. But I think really an even more important part that's more broadly expansive and goes beyond just the, you know, arguing with a scientist is this. It's Christian culture, right? It's this idea that, you know, we have wonderful family dinners at our home. We cook together and we laugh together and we sing a glorious song before dinner and we all share what we're grateful about and we gather around a wonderful roasted chicken with some baked Brussels sprouts and wine and some sourdough bread with some honey and some wonderful sea salt and we all eat dinner and sometimes we'll dance a little bit before dinner or sing a little bit before dinner and we tell stories and we play games and then we finish dinner and we all clean up together and you know, we feed our wonderful pets and our dogs and we go up to the bedroom and we curl up and we read a story and we smile and we laugh and we write down in our journals, you know, what we're grateful for and how we lived our purpose that day and we do self-examination, you know, what could we have done good, what could we have done better, and my wife and I kiss the kids in the forehead and go in the bedroom and make love and snuggle up and fall asleep with smiles on our faces. And then like Groundhog Day, wake up the next day and, you know, rinse, wash, and repeat that wonderful, glorious, glorious event. You know, if you're educating your children and raising your family and living with your loved one in that spirit of intense love and forgiveness and peace and joy that pours into your life, when you receive that free gift of salvation, people can't help but notice that, right? And so right. When you have someone over for, say, like a dinner, and they are someone who perhaps it doesn't really understand that hope or hasn't been around it, and all of a sudden they're in a room and the parents and the kids aren't fighting and the phones are off the table and everybody's singing and happy and enjoying God's creation. And maybe there's even a couple other people from town who are poor and who are needy and who maybe, you know, it's the boy that my kids met at the jiu-jitsu gym who, you know, who doesn't have a dad, who's just living at home poor with his mom, but his mom and him are there eating a, you know, big old ribeye that they never would have been able to get otherwise. And somebody else who's not saved is sitting across the table from them. And there's a couple Christians around. I mean, what happens is eventually people ask, and I've found this over and over again. People are just like, what is it? Like, what's different about you guys? Like, why is it that, you know, when stuff goes wrong, you just smile and say, praise God, you know, he sends the good and the bad. God is good. And he has the reason for everything. He has a great story written out for my life. You know, praise God for this meal that we can enjoy while laughing and singing and rejoicing. And, you know, praise God for the beauty of nature and this walk we're going on after dinner. You know, people ask, and then you just tell them, you know, you tell them, you say, hey, you know, this is the hope that you have when you believe that life is bigger than atoms and protons and neutrons and chemicals, and that there's this intelligent force and this spiritual universe, this unseen realm that exists outside of us, and that a great story has been written for your life in a way that J.R.R. Tolkien wrote the story of Bilbo Baggins, and you have your own hero's journey, and all you need to do is wake up every day and do the very best job with everything that God has put on your plate. And the only thing that you need to do, like, there's nothing that you can do. Like, you can go out and try to do all this good stuff and try to be whatever, nice to your wife and take care of your kids and eat wonderful meals and have people over for dinner. But at the end of the day, you know, regardless of all that, what you're going to crave and love to do once you've actually kind of had your eyes open to the light, all you need to do is say, you know, I believe I'm a sinner. I need forgiveness. I believe that God sent his son, his beloved son, down to this earth to be a nasty human, poop in his diaper and get scars and eventually get nailed to a cross, the worst curse anyone could ever wish upon a fellow human being, and eventually die. But I believe he was resurrected. He was buried. He died. He was resurrected. And I want him to be a part of my life. I want to be anointed with the Holy Spirit. And I believe that Jesus did what the Bible says that he did, and I want to be a part of that. And that's all you have to say. Like, that's the classic sinner's prayer. And at that point, you know, after someone has seen the joy that pours forth, and after they've been told that it really is that simple, and then it's not a matter of begrudgingly going forward and trying to be good. No, it's a matter of you loving that feeling so much that you can't but crave to do all these good things. I really think that's the best way. That's the best argument, is you just live an extraordinary life as a divine image bearer of God. You show people that extraordinary life. You love other people. And if they ask you, you tell them how simple it is to have that same life for themselves, with the only exception being that if you're sitting next to somebody on a plane and you know you're never going to see him again, it's just fine to say, hey, yo, I just want to tell you something. Jesus loves you, and you can believe on him right now if you want to. Here's how to do it. Here's a sinner's prayer. You know, put a little card in their hand if you have it written down, or give them your number. Say, hey, have a great day. But, you know, in most cases, you know, living an extraordinary life, and then when people ask, tell them about that extraordinary life, I think is the best way to defend all of the world's arguments about, you know, why there isn't a God.
Man, such powerful words. I love that caveat at the end about the airplane. When I first committed my life to Christ, it was because I saw people like yourself living with a joy about them that I didn't possess. And I started looking around at the people that I was looking to, that I was admiring, and there was a common denominator there, and they were all Christians, which led me to dig in. I got really into the apologetics works. If you're not familiar with them, I love Lee Strobel's work. I started with Case for Christ and kind of branched out from there. And to tie up your deal and what you said at the end, Matthew 5:16, let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. When you have people over and you show them that joy that you have, you don't have to, you know, preach the gospel to them specifically. You're doing it through your actions. I absolutely love that. Ben has a book called The Christian Gratitude Journal that I finished to completion. And now he has a book called The Spiritual Disciplines Journal that I'm digging into. The Christian Gratitude Journal is probably my most gifted book that I've given. It has impacted so many lives. There's so much science out there about gratitude practices. And then when you center it around a very quick Bible verse reading in the morning, it centers around your day. And then now with The Spiritual Disciplines Journal, we talked recently on my podcast with many guests about how I now use wins to end my day. And I was doing that before the Spiritual Disciplines Journal, and now it's in there for me. What good have you done today? What's one way you lived your purpose, and what's one thing you could do better? And honestly, the one thing I could have done better has been rocking me a little bit, because I had been so focused on gratitude and what were some wins for my day. It's been great for me from a self-examination standpoint. So I truly appreciate you putting that out there.
We learn from our failures. And, you know, I constantly remind my children this, because I see them when we gather in a journal and we get to that question, what could I have done better this day? You know, they're very good at saying, for kids, it's so simple, right? It's like, I didn't do math, or I skipped my piano practice. And it's not about beating yourself up. It's about saying, okay, how can I rise to the occasion, become better each day by learning from that failure? Last night, Eric, I wrote in my journal that I didn't write yesterday. And I write like every day. And I had a super busy day. I didn't prioritize writing. I did check Instagram. I did check Facebook. I did check Twitter. I did tool around on emails for probably too long, but I didn't write yesterday. But when I write that in my journal, the next day changes. You know, I got up at 4:40 this morning and I spent an hour writing. And you know, that was because of what I wrote in my journal last night. Because the last thing I want to do is ever write, what could I have done better? I never want to write that same response in my journal ever again. Right. Mm-hmm. And so every single day you become a better person via that process of self-examination, which the ancient church fathers and mothers and folks like, I forget who came up with the term examine, but it was basically this process of examining one's life, all the way to Benjamin Franklin and his Book of Virtues and his journal and what he would write in his journal. And that part of it was that process of self-examination. What good have I done today? And what could I have done better? You know, we see that process repeatedly used in the lives of a lot of great people, you know, learning from failures, not just dwelling on the positive affirmations, but also on the things you could have done better. And yeah, I really wanted to weave that into the Spiritual Disciplines Journal, and I'm glad you're using it, man.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. Thank you so much for that. We're going to be sensitive of your time, two recurring questions, and we're going to get out of here. You're so well-read. It'd be tough to pick your favorite book. If you have a favorite, that's perfect. If not, what are you reading right now?
Well, besides the elephant in the room, of course, the Bible, the only book that you say you really need if you go to Desert Island. You know, I've been digging Randy Elkhorn's books of late. I just read his two books, Heaven and also Happiness. Those are two stellar books, Heaven being a really good examination. You know, what is Heaven really going to be? And I'll tell you what, it's not a bunch of us playing harp sitting on a fluffy white cloud. It's glorious. It's pretty much everything that we have access to right now on Earth, but perfect and glorious and without sin, and just an amazing adventure for the rest of all time, which is wonderful to think about. And then Happiness is just about finding more happiness and joy in your life through God. And so I read a lot of Randy Alcorn. I read a lot of John Piper. I read a lot of Doug Wilson. I read you know, a lot of some of the older guys like C.S. Lewis, for example. So I'm constantly exploring. I also like the app Thinker. Thinker's kind of like Blinkist, but it reviews largely books that I think are very positive in terms of cultural Christianity and just a really good perspective on everything that we're experiencing in the world right now. And it's probably probably one of the better like book review little apps that I use to discover new books. Those are a few books that come to mind.
Last question for me. What's next for Ben Greenfeld? This is What's Next with Eric Wood. I'm navigating this journey. What's next for you on your journey?
I've got my supplements company, Keon, that I'm continuing to build, you know, launching new, like we just launched a new ground organic coffee and we're developing some new bars and some new supplements. So I love to tinker around in the kitchen with that. Just launched a cookbook called The Boundless Cookbook. So I really love to cook. But I'll tell you from a writing standpoint, I'm working on a new book about endurance, particularly spiritual stamina, resistance to temptation, and building up one's spiritual armor to be able to withstand all the fiery arrows that the world throws at you. So that book's called Endure. I'm trying to have that one done by Christmas. From a personal standpoint, I am fostering my two boys through
their first kind of like rite of passage into adolescence. They're both 13 years old. And so we're spending a lot of time focusing on wilderness survival and nature awareness and everything that they need to survive and go through rite of passage. That will be their recognition of passage into adolescence. And then finally, from just a pure fun and hobby standpoint, I'm recording my first album right now. My guitar in my little office, just nice. Writing some spiritual songs and hymns and doing some old goodies like, old hymns like My Father's World and bringing the family in for a few. And so kind of putting my first album out. And those are a few things I'm working on.
Good for you, man. And we will attach in the show notes your website, your tags, everywhere where people can find you. Follow Ben Greenfield all over social media. Go to his website, read his books. He's an absolute light to this world. He makes so much impact through the health and wellness space and then also in Christian spheres. I can't thank you enough for the impact you've had on me and my journey in health and wellness since getting the news that my career was over. You've had a tremendous impact on me throughout that time and then especially here today on the podcast. Thank you for your time here today.
Thanks for having me on, Eric. I'm looking forward to learning a little bit more about you and what you do and tuning into your show. So I'm honored you have me on, man.
Thanks,
man. Amazing Thursday.
Thanks, brother.
All right, later, man.
This episode is also brought to you by Punched Energy Chews, and these have become a favorite product of mine for energy and fitness. They use a patented formula with tons of scientific studies, and they start with pure green Arabica coffee bean caffeine. It improves your physical and mental performance, increases your metabolism, helps burn calories and body fat, and they also help boost your immunity, which is very important at this time because they're a great source of vitamin C. They're also ultra low glycemic, no spikes, no bounces, and no crashes. What you're going to do is go to punchedenergy.com, use code ERICWOOD20 for 20% off. Give them a try, link in the show notes. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend or with your followers on social media. Also, shoot us a rating and support the sponsors whose information is in the show notes. Until next time, as I tell my daughter before she leaves for school every day, spread some joy and make it the best day ever.